what you do is spin it around. Just follow your heart, your revolution starts now. Yeah, the revolution starts now. In your own backyard, in your own hometown. What you do is spin it around. Just follow your heart, your revolution starts now.
My opinion, Israel controls Middle East policy in the United States. Trump is in the pocket of Netanyahu, it seems. Without U.S. military support, Israel would not have been able to maintain their slaughter of Gaza for more than a few months. The United States enables Israel to ignore international law and to reject every single peace agreement. This is not an exaggeration.
That's Richard Forer. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. Noam Chomsky calls...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We're going to have a bill, the one big beautiful bill. I think it's going to be, it's the biggest bill ever passed, and we got to get it done. Tremendous tax cuts for people, tremendous incentives, tremendous regulation cuts, all these regulations that are so horrible.
President Trump makes a rare visit to Capitol Hill to push House Republicans to support a sweeping budget bill that gives massive tax breaks to the rich. The Congressional Budget Office says the bill will result in more than half a trillion dollars in Medicare cuts, in addition to sweeping cuts to Medicaid and Obamacare. We'll speak to Bishop William Barber, who's been arrested twice in recent weeks protesting the cuts.
What they're considering right now would cost coverage, would take millions of people, not hundreds and thousands, but millions of people away from Medicaid. We're talking about $880 billion in cuts over 10 years.
We'll also speak about the budget bill with disability rights activist Julie Farrar of ADAPT and reporter Arjun Singh of The Lever, which has just released an audio series called The Tax Revolt on the history of the Republican anti-tax movement, then to America's brain drain.
I believe we're experiencing the great American healthcare tragedy, and it centers around a massive misallocation of federal government funds.
As the Trump administration slashes spending on healthcare and scientific research, we'll look at the long-term impacts of Trump's anti-science agenda as scientists look to take their research overseas. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military is continuing its assault on Gaza, killing at least 52 people since sunrise this morning. As Palestinian health officials warn of a growing hunger catastrophe, 80 days after Israel imposed a total blockade on food, water, and medicine, the United Nations says no aid has been distributed in Gaza due to tight restrictions imposed by Israel, which has allowed just a handful of aid trucks into the territory in the last days. That's despite the UN's warning on Tuesday that 14,000 babies are at risk of dying without immediate aid. Gaza's health ministry says at least 326 deaths have been linked to malnutrition and lack of medicine since March, while 300 pregnant Palestinians have suffered miscarriages caused by nutritional deficiencies. This is a displaced Palestinian mother in Gaza City.
Life is very, very difficult. We hear about those aid trucks coming in. Some 9 vehicles, others say 12 vehicles, and it's all lies. We don't see anything sent to us.
The United Kingdom has suspended trade talks with Israel and will impose sanctions on West Bank settlers. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Keir Starmer called Israel's announcement that it would allow a small quantity of food into Gaza for its starving population of over 2 million totally and utterly inadequate. This is British Foreign Secretary David Lammy.
The world is judging. History will judge them. Blocking aid, expanding the war, dismissing the concerns of your friends and partners, this is indefensible, and it must stop.
On Tuesday, the European Union's foreign policy chief said the 27-nation bloc will review its political and economic agreements with Israel over the catastrophic situation in Gaza. Separately, Spain's parliament passed a non-binding resolution Tuesday calling on the government to impose an arms embargo on Israel. This comes as the head of the opposition Israel Democratic Party, Yair Golan, condemned the Netanyahu government's siege of Gaza during an interview with Israeli public radio.
Israel is on its way to becoming a pariah state among nations, like South Africa was, if we don't return to acting like a sane country. And a sane country does not wage war against civilians, does not kill babies as a hobby, and does not give itself the aim of expelling populations.
Here in the United States, President Trump made a rare visit to Capitol Hill Tuesday to push House Republicans to support a sweeping budget bill that gives massive tax breaks to the rich while slashing spending for Medicaid, nutritional assistance, subsidies for clean energy. One estimate shows nearly 14 million people could lose health coverage under the plan. The Congressional Budget Office warns the bill would trigger some more than $500 billion in automatic cuts to Medicare under the Statutory Pay-as-You-Go Act. Budget negotiations continued through the night as a group of Republicans are pushing for even bigger cuts, while blue state Republicans are seeking larger tax breaks by increasing the deduction on state and local taxes. After headlines, we'll have more on the Republican budget bill with Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign. We'll also speak with ADAPT, the disability rights organization. The Trump administration's reportedly deported a group of immigrants from Burma and Vietnam to the nation of South Sudan, potentially in violation of a previous federal court order that restricts the removal of immigrants to a third country without proper due process. On Tuesday evening, U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy in Boston ordered Trump officials to maintain custody of the immigrants transferred to South Sudan to, quote, ensure the practical feasibility of return in case the court finds their removal is illegal and orders their return to the U.S. One of the Burmese immigrants flown to South Sudan, identified in court documents as NM, has limited English proficiency and refused to sign a removal order given to him in English only. This comes amidst increasing conflict and fears of a new civil war in South Sudan. In more immigration news, a report by the Cato Institute says dozens of Venezuelans, more than 50, who were transferred from the U.S. to El Salvador's Secat mega prison in March had pending asylum appointments after they entered the U.S. using the Biden-era app CBP1. At least one had a temporary visa, while four others had authorization to live in the U.S. through the refugee program. Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee grilled Secretary of State Marco Rubio Tuesday over his support for President Trump's agenda, including the deportation of immigrants without due process to El Salvador's Secat prison. Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen, who in April traveled to El Salvador to campaign for the return of Salvadoran immigrant Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a father who lived in Maryland, said he regretted voting to confirm Rubio. Rubio shot back, calling Abrego Garcia a gangbanger while providing no evidence.
In the case of El Salvador, absolutely, absolutely. We deported gang members, including the one you had a margarita with. And that guy is a human trafficker, and that guy is a gangbanger, and the evidence is going to be clear. In the days to come, you're going to see who you went to defend.
Senator, I'm sorry, please, Secretary Rubio has the floor.
Mr. Chairman, he can't make unsubstantiated comments like that.
Secretary Rubio has the floor.
Separately, Secretary Rubio told Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy he was not aware that President Trump is set to host a private gala dinner on Thursday at Trump's golf club in Northern Virginia for the top 220 investors in the Trump cryptocurrency meme coin, even though the event has been widely reported and will feature many foreign investors. The majority are from other countries.
Do you have a list of those foreign individuals who will be meeting with the president?
I don't. I don't know anything about it. I didn't even know there was a dinner on Thursday night, so I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is drawing backlash following a hearing in front of the Senate Homeland Security Committee Tuesday in which she botched the definition of habeas corpus. This is Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire questioning Noem about the constitutional right that safeguards people from being illegally detained.
So, Secretary Noem, what is habeas corpus?
Well, habeas corpus is a constitutional right that the president has to be able to remove people from this country
Habeas corpus is the legal principle that requires that the government provide a public reason for detaining and imprisoning people. If not for that protection, the government could simply arrest people, including American citizens, and hold them indefinitely for no reason. Habeas corpus is the foundational right that separates free societies like America from police states like North Korea.
Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee grilled President Trump's nominee to be the next commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service Tuesday. Under questioning from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, former Missouri Republican Congressmember Billy Long refused to state that it's illegal for the president to weaponize the IRS against his political opponents.
Is it illegal for the president to instruct the IRS to remove nonprofit status from a taxpayer?
I'm not going to have the answer that you need, and I apologize, but it, like I said,
why are you not having the answer?
Meanwhile, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden said his staff has at least two recordings of Long's business associates saying they expect to get favors from the IRS once Long is installed as its commissioner. President Trump Tuesday proposed a missile defense project modeled after Israel's Iron Dome. Trump's Golden Dome calls for the U.S. to spend $540 billion over 20 years to launch a network of satellites that could track and intercept missiles launched at the United States. The project would likely be a massive boon to Elon Musk's private rocket company, SpaceX, which dominates the commercial launch sector. Here in New York, Columbia University's acting president, Claire Shipman, was met with loud boos and chants of Free Mahmoud as she walked up to the stage during graduation ceremony Tuesday.
Please welcome the acting president of Columbia University, Claire Shipman.
The work of your generation will be to shape these interesting times, to define the values.
The peaceful protest was in reference to Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil, who remains in an ICE jail in Louisiana after being taken from his apartment on campus by federal agents in March. Meanwhile, newly released surveillance footage from Columbia shows Khalil complied and cooperated with the officers after they illegally entered his private Columbia-owned apartment building without a warrant. The footage contradicts claims by Trump officials who said Khalil attempted to flee. Khalil is scheduled to appear in immigration court tomorrow in Gina, Louisiana, where he remains behind bars. To see our coverage of this story, go to democracynow.org. In media news, the president and CEO of CBS News has stepped down, becoming the latest high-profile official to leave the network. Wendy McMahon said in a memo to CBS staff on Monday, quote, "It's become clear that the company and I do not agree on the path forward," unquote. Her departure comes as CBS's corporate owner, Paramount, is seeking FCC approval to complete an $8.4 billion merger with Skydance Media. And as Paramount is in talks to settle a $20 billion lawsuit filed by Donald Trump, who objected to the way CBS's 60 Minutes edited an interview with Kamala Harris. FCC Commissioner Ana Gomez called McMahon's departure beyond alarming, writing, quote, "Independent journalists are being silenced simply because their reporting may threaten the ambitions of their corporate owners. It will only embolden an administration hell-bent on censoring speech and controlling content," unquote. And in Mexico, the personal secretary and advisor to Mexico City's mayor were assassinated by gunmen on motorcycles in broad daylight Tuesday. Mayor Clara Brugada, who is a member of the ruling Morena Party and is an ally of President Claudia Sheinbaum, confirmed the killing, saying her secretary, Jimena Guzman, and advisor Jose Munoz were shot dead in a direct attack. This came just hours after at least seven young men, including minors, were killed as gunmen opened fire on a group in the central Mexican state of Guanajuato, where warring drug cartels indiscriminately target local communities. Residents are demanding justice. This is priest Jose de Jesus Perez.
We must never get used to this violence. We don't want to get used to the violent deaths like those that sadly occurred yesterday morning when seven young people were massacred.
The U.S.-backed so-called war on drugs has led to decades of violence in Mexico. An estimated over 450,000 people have been killed since 2006, while another 100,000 have been disappeared. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we look at the House budget bill that gives massive tax breaks to the rich while slashing funds for Medicaid, Obamacare, and even Medicare. Stay with us.
To the misanthropic, misbegotten merchants of gloom, who look into their crystal balls and prophesy our doom, let the death knell chime, it's the end of time. Let the cynics put their blinkers on and toast our decline. Don't become demoralized by this chorus of complaint. It's a sure sign that the old world is terminally quaint and tomorrow's gonna be a better day. No matter what the siren voices say, tomorrow's gonna be a better day.
Tomorrow's Going to Be a Better Day by Billy Bragg in our Democracy Now! Studio more than a decade ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump made a rare visit to Capitol Hill to push House Republicans to support a sweeping budget bill that gives massive tax breaks to the rich while slashing spending for Medicaid, food stamps, and subsidies for clean energy. One estimate shows nearly 14 million people could lose health coverage. A new analysis by the Congressional Budget Office says the bill will also trigger $535 billion in Medicare cuts. Negotiations on the bill continued through the night as a group of Republicans are pushing for even bigger spending cuts, while blue state Republicans are seeking larger tax breaks by increasing the deduction on state and local taxes. Sorry. Let's go to President Trump.
This is the greatest bill that will ever, I think it's the most important bill this country just about has ever done in terms of size and scope. That's why we call it the Great Big Beautiful Deal. I mean, it really is. The bill is, I think it's going to be one of the most important. It's the biggest tax reduction in history, biggest regulation reduction in history. Incredible for Medicaid, for Medicare.
And now we go to Democratic Congressmember Brendan Boyle, who outlined how the bill would cut more than half a trillion dollars in Medicare cuts.
This is really the breaking news, because when the Budget Committee kicked off this process approximately 3 months ago, there was a commitment by President Trump that there would be no Medicare cuts in this piece of legislation. And indeed, over the last several months, there's been no discussion of Medicare at all. There has been of Medicaid, but not of Medicare. Well, here we are tonight because, as you explained, because of the size of the deficits, because of the pay-go or pay-as-you-go act, That would trigger sequestration of Medicare, and it would total over $500 billion. The official figure that CBO confirms is $535 billion in cuts to Medicare.
We're now joined by Bishop William Barber, president of Repairers of the Breach. Thank you so much for being with us. You are also national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. You've been arrested at least twice in the last few months protesting this bill. Can you talk about your major concerns? The Republicans are calling this bill the Big Beautiful Bill Act. Democrats are calling it cutting taxes for the rich. What do you say, Bishop Barber?
Thank you so much, Amy. And I was talking to Joan Baez about this the other day, about how ugly the times are and yet how we must stand. And we've got to sharpen our language. I was arrested with others, and we were arrested in the rotunda for simply praying about the ugliness of this bill. And people who represent thousands, hundreds of thousands of religious congregants were arrested, and we're going back June 2nd for a mass moral Monday sponsored by Repairers of Breach and 20 other partners, because we have to stand up in this moment. This is a big, ugly, destructive, deadly bill. And we have to start talking about it in those terms. It's not just about tax cuts to the wealthy. It is about that. But it is about death dealing and destruction to the poor and the elderly and the youth of our country, regardless of what their color is. In fact, one of the things we need to be doing is disaggregating what will happen in these states and in various communities, whether you're in Appalachia or you're in Alabama. They lie and say that this is about cutting fraud, and it really is not. It is about cutting legitimate and life-giving and necessary programs that we fought for years. Real quickly, Amy, I want your listeners to understand, when we talk about cutting Medicaid, we're talking about primarily low-income individuals of all races, creeds, and colors, families, children, pregnant women, and elderly people, and people with disabilities. Now we're hearing $500 billion cuts to Medicare. We're talking about persons who are 65 years or older. We're talking about children who have kidney disease, life-ending kidney disease, and people who have Lou Gehrig's disease. We know that for every 1 million people that are denied health care, some 2,500 people, some studies say, actually die. And we're talking about a time where we're already having 800 people dying a day from the effects of poverty and low wages. This is a big, bad, ugly, deadly, destructive bill. And it must be resisted everywhere, in the places of power, in our pulpits, in the streets. We must pray, put our bodies on the line, because what we're talking about here is 13.7 million people could lose Medicare and their health insurance. We also know that there's no way to do this kind of cutting without eventually also getting to Social Security. The numbers just will not work. We also know that Bannon has said in a video that he did that their goal is to control the $5 trillion budget so they can control the 70-some trillion dollar assets owned by the government. This is a massive takeover, a big, bad, ugly, destructive, deadly bill. Talking about 11 million children who would lose food stamp. People lose food stamp. 4 million of those are children. We're talking about $6.5 billion of investment in green energy being cut. And they say that they're making these tax cuts to help society. But the very school that Trump often claims and brags about, he attended the Wharton School, has said that for low-income America, for poor and low-income people, the changes to the tax code in the House bill means they will have less annual income. They will lose an average of $1,035. But for the wealthiest people in this country, it says that they will get an average of $389,000+ more per year. This is a big, bad, ugly, deadly, destructive bill that will hurt poor people, will hurt low-wage people, and ultimately will hurt America. And if they do it, they want to do it for 10 years. You're going to see massive destruction in rural health care. You're going to see these immoral cuts where the rich have more, the poor and working people have less. And then they want to put more money, not only what they're cutting, but another $350 billion into defense contractors and more money into deportation. So basically what they want to do is take this budget and codify the vision and the goals of Musk and DOG into this budget. And they want to do it, Amy Lashley, with a reconciliation process that means they only need 51 votes, not 60, but 51 votes. Trump has said one thing that is true. This is a great deal, but it's not great in the sense of good. It is a great, big, bad, ugly, destructive, deadly, debilitating bill that will hurt Americans and poor, low-wage people for years and years to come and could be the very undermining of our democracy if we allow it to go forward.
Bishop Barber, in rural areas specifically, there's been reports of many hospitals that may be forced to close in rural communities as a result of cuts in federal funding. Could you talk about in your areas of North Carolina and other rural areas the direct impact that will result from this?
Well, remember, COVID exposed a whole lot of our problem with our health system. And so we know that the states, for instance, didn't expand Medicaid. During COVID, many, many, many people died that didn't have to die. And we saw the rate of death in poor and low-wage states, whether they were predominantly white or predominantly black, were about the same level. It was gross. It was immoral. It was bad. We also know that because states didn't accept Medicaid expansion, and this bill would roll back a lot of Medicaid expansion, would roll back Medicaid, which is critical to keeping rural hospitals open. So let me give you a story of what we're going to see, what we've already seen. In North Carolina, for instance, when North Carolina refused to expand Medicaid, there's a lady, young lady named Portia. I met her. Portia was the first person to die in Belhaven, North Carolina, a rural community, after that hospital was closed. And because of the cuts in the denial of Medicaid expansion. They had a hospital, had had it for 30, 40, 50 years. It could not survive. You know, she died in the parking lot, of a school, waiting on the helicopter to come. And the doctor said if that hospital had been there, she would have probably lived because she would have been able to get to care within what we call the golden hour. This bill goes forward, you're going to hear more of that. More hospitals cut, more rural hospitals cut, more inner city hospitals cut, more hospitals disabled from carrying out their duties to care for the people. And I want to just drive home, Amy and Juan, that we've got to get folk to see how this is affecting lives. We have to start talking about this budget as a form of social and political murder. Social and political deadliness, because they know, and the reason I use the word murder is because they know that it's going to cause death. The studies are out there that tell what happens when you cut more and more health care, and yet they're pushing through, and they're pushing through in the middle of the night. They do not want to have this debate during the day when people are up and they can see what's going on. They're doing it at night because this is a great, big, bad, ugly, deadly, destructive budget bill.
And yet, Bishop Barber, there are some Republicans that are holding out support because they want even more cuts than the present bill that is being shepherded by Speaker Johnson. What is your response to how people should resist or deal with the maneuvers in Congress in these coming days?
Budgets are moral documents. That's why we're calling on people to join us June the 2nd on Monday for a mass moral Monday right in front of the Supreme Court and in the Capitol. Clergy are coming in full vestments. We're inviting clergy. Clergy are bringing impacted people and other advocates. We have to stand up everywhere and declare that this is not about Democrat or Republican, as we said in 2018, or left versus right. This is really about right versus wrong. And this should be our total focus, because if you allow this with this budget, you dismantle the government. This is their attempt to so-called dismantle the state, administrative state, but it's deadly and it's destructive. And we have to call it a moral issue, and we have to put a face on who's actually going to be hurt and what's actually going to happen. I'm calling on every news agency should be putting up maps of the United States and show where the cuts are going to be so that folk can understand this is not going to affect people outside of your community. It's going to affect your community. Every Democratic congressperson, or if there's a Republican that's against it, should bring impact to people, to the gallery. They should be walking through the congressional offices in the Capitol. Make the folk have to see who they will actually be hurting, whose lives they will be putting on the line. This is gut check time for America. This is gut check time for the moral voices of this country. We cannot stand down in this moment. If this goes into effect, we're talking about 10 years that this country could be hampered and hurt with what will happen with this budget. And it's not just what they're cutting, it's what they're funding. They're cutting the programs that bring life. They're funding programs that bring more death and more deportation and more destruction. Either way you look at it, this is a great, big, ugly, deadly, bad, destructive, disabling bill. And we have to stand against it in every way. No one can be on the side, especially moral leaders, pastors and clergy, imams and rabbis who pastor and care for the people, because we, particularly those in congregation leaders, will bury the people. We'll have to be with the families that whose lives will be cut short because of this great, big, ugly, deadly, destructive, disabilitating bill that they're trying to push through. And lastly, one,
we have 30 seconds.
I don't know what's in the mind of people that you get up in the morning. What kind of mythology has gotten a hold of your mind that all you can figure out to do with power is how many people you can hurt, how many lives you can put at risk, how many lives you can destroy, how much bad policy. It is a sickness. And those of us who've not been bound by that sickness, it's time that we have to stand up in this moment.
Bishop William Barber, president at Repairers of the Breach, founding director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School, also national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Thanks so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Last week on Capitol Hill, police arrested more than 24 people, including many disability rights activists, as they protested Republican plans to gut Medicaid and other programs for the poor and working class to help cover the cost of $4.5 trillion in tax breaks for the rich. Protesters lined the halls outside a meeting of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, while inside, a demonstrator was led away by police after disrupting the hearing. Security wheeled this protester in her wheelchair out of the congressional hearing. For more, I want to bring into this conversation Julie Farrar, an activist with ADAPT, a disability rights group, who joined some 90 people from her group in disrupting the congressional hearing over Trump's new proposed budget bill. Welcome to Democracy Now! Julie, first describe your gravest concerns right now as the House met through the night to try to get this bill passed.
Well, I just want to say that it is an honor to be on with Reverend Barber and echo what he said. This big, beautiful bill for billionaires is going to kill people. We are putting, ADAPT has been around for 44 years, and we fought for the expansion of rights for disabled people, for people who are aging into disability. So, in the 90s, I crawled up the steps to the Capitol to get the Americans with Disabilities Act passed. I was able to go to school because of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And now, instead of fighting to expand the right to live in the community and fight for better wages for our home care workers, a large percentage of our home care workers are older immigrant women of color. And make no mistake, President Trump is going after immigrants. He's going after immigrants, period. And so when we're putting our bodies on the line, it's because our bodies are on the line. Cuts to Medicaid in this already very fragile spider web is not a safety net. It's a spider web of services. ADAPT is fighting for affordable, accessible housing and Medicaid and services, fully funding those, and livable wages for our home care workers. And all of these are under attack right now. It's just appalling that they are literally stealing money from poor people's pockets to pay for billionaires' rockets. And Elon Musk is the largest recipient of welfare. Make no mistake. We have to rely on this very fragile web of services. So if our benefits are effective, our Social Security goes up by $6, then our rent can go up by $12, or we can lose the ability to live in low-income housing. We can lose Medicaid. With disabled people, we're putting our lives on the line because we know that our lives are on the line. There were 26 people in there that were arrested, and that woman was not with ADAPT, but she is now. She's from Ohio. We connected, and she's looking at starting an ADAPT chapter there. And we do believe that one of the tools in social justice that is very effective is direct action. So we're putting our bodies on the line because it is our lives that are going to be affected. I know people that are going to die without their home care services. As this budget cuts Medicaid and puts caps on how much money can be spent, and then also punishes states that actually have been carrying the red states with the taxes that we pay, but punishing states that states that will not implement these ridiculous immigration acts, those states are going to be punished by money, by the federal money that is spent on Medicaid and other programs. That money is going to be taken away, and that is going to hurt programs. Like, we have a program called Money Follows the Person that helps people get out of nursing homes and into the community. That is our fight. We hear so much about grandma's going to be thrown out of the nursing home. ADAPT is all about keeping grandma at home, that to make sure that she has the services that she needs to remain in her community and age in place. And all of these services are going to be affected. Housing is going to be affected. The energy assistance program and those green energy projects, those helped a lot of poor and disabled people be able to stay in their homes. And
Julie, if I can ask you also, the bill would require more frequent income and work verifications to qualify for Medicaid. How will these changes affect especially people with disabilities?
The easiest way to describe what is going to happen to the majority of people is it's going to be attrition from the program, because now instead of me having to prove that I'm disabled, I was born missing 12 vertebrae, I can pray and I can take vitamins, and I am still going to be disabled. So every 6 months I have to prove that I'm disabled enough to qualify for Medicaid. If you are receiving long-term care services, whether it's in a nursing home or in your own home, and also wheelchairs and all of our medical equipment, the only payer for those are Medicaid and Medicare, period. And when these cuts go into place, it is just ludicrous, because you have outdated federal computer systems, and then you have outdated state computer systems, and then you have outdated county computer systems, and they're going to have to communicate with each other, and they're not going to be able to. And people are going to fall off because they haven't qualified. They haven't turned in, their application hasn't been processed in a timely fashion. So there's going to be a lot of that is just attrition, but there is not a way for them to figure out who is on Medicaid. And if you're disabled, you have to have less than $2,000 in assets. So you have to be impoverished, but you're supposed to work. These people every 6 months are going to have to prove this, and they're going to have some sort of system to know who is elderly or who is disabled, who cannot work. And it's just, there's no way for that to happen. It's going to kill people. It's degrading, it's demeaning. And I want to remind people that the cruelty is the point. The cruelty is the point of this. Poor people are going to pay. Disabled people are going to die. And it is blood on the hands of the GOP and the president and the administration that they want this big, beautiful bill for billionaires that will kill poor people and it will kill disabled people.
Julie Farrar,
it's a bureaucracy.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, joining us from Albany, disability rights activists with ADAPT. Among the signs that people carried into that hearing were our homes, not nursing homes. And for our radio audience who is just listening, if you go to democracynow.org, you'll see the footage of the wheelchair warriors who disrupted the House hearing. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Republican plan to slash taxes on the rich. To talk about it, we're joined in Washington, D.C. By The Lever's Arjun Singh, senior producer, co-host of the podcast Lever Time, which has a series called Tax Revolt about the history of the Republican anti-tax movement. This is a trailer for the series.
From the landmark California tax revolt to Trump's latest push to cut taxes for the rich, this movement claimed to fight for the average American, but really deepened inequality and helped the rich get richer.
This is the story of how a small but powerful movement reshaped our economy, weakened our democracy, and left the government scrambling to serve the people it was meant to protect.
But that's not the way the world is, guys. Do you want to sit there and scream and holler and hate rich people and lose every election?
It is time for a wealth tax in America.
You'll lose everything. If you don't lose the election, you'll lose the country. So, there you got it. You with me?
That is a trailer for the series Tax Revolt about the history of the Republican anti-tax movement. The Lever's Arjun Singh joins us now. Thanks, Arjun, for being with us. If you can give us the history about what we're seeing, while many call this the big, beautiful bill, the Republicans in Congress, of course, President Trump, who visited them yesterday to try to bring together all the parties to pass this, others are simply calling it the billionaire's tax cut bill. Explain where this comes from.
Thanks for having me, Amy. It's great to be with you. This bill is really the culmination of a longstanding effort of the Republican Party to pull together different coalitions that really don't have a lot in common except for being united under the banner of the anti-tax movement. In the 1970s, the Republican Party was trying to build a base out of anti-communism and being fervently anti-communist, but this was a bipartisan thing. So in 1978, after a California ballot election, where conservative activists convinced Californians to cap the property tax rate, Republicans realized that tax cutting could be a very powerful force for uniting different groups that may not seem to be bedfellows with each other. And so you have different coalitions in there. You have billionaires, of course, who want their tax cuts. You have business interests who want to be able to game the tax code. But then you also have members of the Republican base, people who are legitimately anti-government in that they believe that there should be no government or an incredibly limited form of government, potentially kicked down to the states. And then you have other people who see the government as a tool of ideology that they don't agree with. And so starting with the Reagan era and into the 1990s and now, of course, into Trump, you have a very strong coalition of Republicans who genuinely believe that the government has been hijacked by an ideological force. They believe it's become too tolerant and too liberal. And so they see the tax issue as a means of actually defunding an entire federal government that they completely hate. The other parts of the coalition are people who are deficit hawks and they have an ideological hatred of deficit spending. And so this coalition that Trump is trying to pull together is trying to please everybody. But what's awkward about this is that Trump himself has created an awkward part of the coalition that relies on a lot of government services. And what you're seeing now with his efforts to cut Medicaid, Elon Musk and Doge, is that a lot of parts of the Republican base right now not only rely on these services, they like these services, and there's no way you can please this coalition. Either you have to raise the debt ceiling, which the deficit hawks do not want,
or you have to acknowledge that the government services are vital and figure out a funding mechanism. President Trump has proposed, and then he walked it back, raising taxes on millionaires, showing the strength of the anti-tax movement, or you raise taxes and you find a functioning government. But what Trump is trying to figure out right now is how do you pull these people together? They have very few votes, and it looks like they're not going to be able to pull it together. Maybe things can happen at the last hour, but currently they are very much in a fight, and this is the culmination of that effort to glue together a really strange coalition that in many ways does not get along.
For your series on the left, you also interviewed Grover Norquist, the head of the conservative advocacy group Americans for Tax Reform. What did he tell you, and why is he such an important figure?
So Grover Norquist told me that this issue comes down to one thing, freedom. And that's, I should make clear, that's freedom for him, not freedom for everybody else to be able to live in a functioning society, freedom for people not to be suppressed by corporate interests, not for the freedom of people to be able to have access to healthcare. He wants no government. And for him, the tax issue is a means of controlling the Republican Party, whipping members in line, and ultimately defunding the government. The reason Grover is really important to this story is that Americans for Tax Reform has been the backbone of the modern anti-tax movement. And he created something called the Anti-Tax Pledge, an actual pledge that elected officials can sign, where they say simply, I will never raise taxes. And using this pledge, Norquist has used it as a bludgeon to go after Republicans, most notably George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush Sr., who committed the original sin of compromising and raising taxes because he had no choice, because he had a Democratic majority. Norquist found the compromise so unacceptable that he rallied people against Bush. And he's turned this party into one where even if people want to raise taxes, President Trump is a good example, because they think that it'll advance another part of their ideological agenda. Norquist's group and his coalition has made it impossible for this party to raise taxes, which then makes it very difficult to actually govern when you're the party in power, which Republicans have been.
But now you express skepticism about their ability to pass this bill, but isn't this bill so important in terms of Trump being able to declare a victory in his first year in office that he will pull out all stops to whip the Republican, the slim majorities in both the House and Senate into line?
I wasn't skeptical of this up until I started reporting on this series. For a long time that I've been covering politics in the era of Trump, I thought that Trump really had created a party where he was a kingmaker and the party was a cult of personality around him. This anti-tax issue might actually be the breaking point for Trump himself. Trump is trying to put himself against the anti-tax movement that has held this entire party together, has actually dominated and controlled this party. And Trump has run as an anti-tax person. But Trump also wants to please different parts of his coalition. And so I think in this case, either he needs to make cuts to Medicaid to please those people, or he needs to figure out how people are going to raise the debt ceiling. But Trump is essentially trying to pass the logic that he is Trump and people should listen to him, and that worked in his first term. And we've seen a lot of rigmarole. They only have a handful of votes that they can lose on this. So really, you only need 1 to 3 people who say, I don't want to cut Medicaid. You have a lot of representatives in actually blue liberal areas who won Republican seats, and they're afraid of their constituents. So that's why I have a little skepticism of if this bill is actually going to pass in the way that it is. I think that the coalition Trump has created, he thought that it was a coalition created around himself. And we're actually seeing that it's a coalition that in many ways is self-interested. Working class voters who switch to the Republican Party lean on these services. People who work in the government lean on these services. And you're also seeing people becoming aware of connecting the dots between the Republican moves and things like not being able to access SNAP benefits, not being able to access your housing assistance. I think that's another key thing here, is that people are recognizing the connection between federal Republican policy and what they see on the ground in their states.
Arjun Singh, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior producer, co-host of the podcast Lever Time, which just released a series called Tax Revolt. Coming up, America's brain drain. Back in 30 seconds.
At the edge of the world, where the first think you are. He plays us with his hate, turns man against man.
The Demagogue by Lila Downs, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the Trump administration slashes spending on health care and scientific research, we end today's show looking at the long-term impacts of Trump's anti-science agenda as scientists look to take their research overseas. For more, we're joined by Robert Hunsicker, environmental journalist whose new piece for Dissident Voices headlined America's Great Brain Drain. Explain exactly what this is, Robert. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's just what it says it is. That's the Trump administration is chasing our scientists out of the country across the board, whether it's in the entire apparatus of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or if it's in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It doesn't matter. They're firing people. They're moving them to lesser positions or moving them from, say, Baltimore to a remote location in Idaho so that they won't appreciate their job any longer. And we're having a massive drain of really the smartest, brightest people that we need to confront health problems in this country.
And they're Robin going to Europe. Robert, in your article, you mentioned that at the same time that the federal government is cutting funding for science, the European Union, Canada, Australia are increasing the amount of money that they're devoting to scientific research to actually lure American scientists to those countries. Could you talk about that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. President Ursula von der Leyen of the EU has dedicated another $500 million to their research agencies to bring specifically U.S. scientists, educators, and academics to the EU. President Macron of France has done the same thing, specifically to bring U.S. scientists to France. And now Germany's doing it, and now Spain has jumped on the bandwagon, and now China is doing the same thing. And they're saying for any Chinese-born or Chinese-American scientists, we're opening up an avenue for you, and we're going to provide grants and pay for you to come. So we're draining our scientific talent, and it's on the way out. You know, Nature, which is the leading journal for science in this country, did just a random poll of 1,600 respondents, and 75% of them said, we're looking to go overseas now. So we're draining one of the most valuable assets we've got in the country.
And what's the long-term impact of this brain drain? What will it be for the United States?
Well, it's going to be very, very serious when it comes to the healthcare area. If you look, for example, at the but let me give you an example of a massive misallocation of resources. And I think this is a point I really want to make. If you look at the HHS, which is the Health and Human Services Department, run by Kennedy, $1.8 trillion budget. Within that, you've got Medicare, Medicaid, those kind of things. And there's some other agencies as well that are crucial to the health of this country. For example, the FDA, Center for Disease Control, and the NIH, National Institutes of Health. Those agencies essentially are the Department of Defense for the interior of this country. They really are. They prevent epidemics and stop them once they come. They are the Department of Defense for the interior of the country, much as the Pentagon is the Department of Defense to protect enemies from raiding our country. Well, we haven't had an invasion since Pearl Harbor, and they're getting $850 billion for the Pentagon. And they want to add $100 billion, Trump does, to that. Meanwhile, let's go over and look on the interior side of defense. And what's happened here is you had 103 million people that were infected 5 years ago with COVID, and 1.2 million of those people died. But guess what? There's a miracle that happened, and that's this. The NIH, and their budget's being cut 40% by Trump, by the way, the NIH brought a vaccine within 1 year. That had never happened before. The fastest vaccine had ever been brought to this country previously was in the 1960s for mumps, and it took 4 years. So you want to cut the agency that saved literally millions of lives by bringing this vaccine within a record time of 1 year. You want to cut them by 40%. And you're thinking about maybe adding another $100 billion to an $850 billion budget where we haven't had one enemy attack to this country since Pearl Harbor. I think that, you know, this is like going down the rabbit hole and having lunch with the Mad Hatter. That's how insane this has become.
Let me ask you, Robert, the Trump administration charged the highly skilled Harvard scientist, Ksenia Petrova, with criminal felony smuggling charges for failing to declare frog samples when she returned to the U.S. in February, usually seen as a minor infraction. She has been detained in an ICE jail in Louisiana and says she faces political persecution if deported to Russia over a protest against the invasion of Ukraine. Her work could lead to major advances in early cancer detection. If you can talk about what message is being sent by Ksenia's detention, the message to scientists, the students that are being detained around the country, the message to international students coming here that they might not only be deported, but imprisoned.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty horrible message, isn't it? I mean, that's the only way to look at it. And it's really, I guess you just got to say we're at the point where this is kind of the epitome of fascism. You know, you look at Huxley's Brave New World, and I'll just read a quickie sentence. But truth's a menace. Science is a public danger. Science is a public danger. Science is a public danger because it seeks the truth. And here's an administration that can't handle seeking the truth. And the circumstance you just talked about is all about that, isn't it?
And your sense, your advice to scientists who are now facing the recruitment efforts of Europe and Canada and Australia and versus the cuts of the Trump administration?
Well, I don't think they have any choice. They've got to take these grants. Their current positions are being demolished. When you take a 40% haircut for the National Institutes of Health, which is the crown jewel of biomedical research in the United States, it's the crown jewel. 99% of the drugs that are approved by the FDA come directly as a result of the National Institutes of Health. And we have fired thousands of scientists there already, demoted the key people. They're gonna head out and go to Europe. You know, if we had a pandemic tomorrow, think of the issue we'd be in. And there's some of the fired employees who remain anonymous have said, if we have another pandemic, we're screwed.
And not to mention Russia, China, I think Australia talked about the Great America brain drain as the Great America brain gain for other countries.
And that's exactly what it is. It's a brain gain for China, for Spain, for France, for Germany, on a go, and Canada, too. And by the way, also Australia. So they're all jumping on the bandwagon. And I guess we'll just have a dumbed down society. That's where we're headed. And I'm not so sure, but with certain segments of it aren't already right there already.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Robert Hunsaker. We are going to link to your piece for Dissident Voice, America's Great Brain Drain, as well as your other articles around the issue of the climate catastrophe. That does it for our broadcast. Happy birthday to Tamari Astudio. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of technology as well as a director of audience. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warner, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Anjali Kamat, Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Uzbek, Emily Anderson, Dante Torrietti, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. By the way, Buffy, happy, happy birthday. If you want to sign up for our daily digest, our newsletter, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, diversity, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
There is a feeling like the clenching of a fist. There is a hunger in the center of the chest. There is a passage through the darkness and the mist. And though the body sleeps, the heart will never rest.
Radio, 88.7 FM, WRHU Radio, Hofstra University, 89.5 FM, Bush Radio. I'm Andy Gladding, and this is a very special edition of One World, although I think every edition of One World is special, but this one's really special because we're all in the studio together. Well, except for Cody. Cody's not here. But our friends from Bush Radio, all the way in Cape Town, are here in studio in New York. How cool. Lydia, our gorgeous co-host, sitting right across from me. What a cool thing, huh?
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. I'm so excited.
I am too. I can't believe you guys are all here. What a great time to come to the United States because, wow, I don't think there's been more of a week of news than the week before a presidential election.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. This is insane. Talk about an election that is going to have an impact far and wide. But before we talk about all that, and trust me, we're not the only people to be talking about that, let's all introduce ourselves because we have special guests that are not usually on the show. So, obviously, Lydia, you can introduce yourself first.
All right. So, I am Lydia Makwanana, and yeah, I'm with Bush Radio, 89.5, right here in Hofstra with you, Andy, and Cody.
And why don't you introduce everybody else around the table?
So, with me, I have Renato.
Hello.
And this is Jasmine.
Say hi.
Hi.
You know, this isn't a TV show. Jasmine's nodding. She's like, yes, I'm here. But you know, we have to hear you.
And then there's Adrian.
Hi.
And Tunisia.
Hi.
Wow, you're nice and loud. We love that. Of course, on the line, we have Cody Millar all the way in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I think we'll just get right into this. I'm just fascinated with the fact that, first of all, that through the magic of communication, we could all get together virtually, but now we're here in person. And for those that don't know, this story of how we all came to get together is a little strange, but it involves reaching out. It involved years ago a connection that I made with Bush Radio, just happened to be in the neighborhood in Salt River, and decided to walk in and say hello. And then many years later, you guys are now here. We've been doing One World for about 2 years now, which is, I think, a record for a lot of radio shows. Over 50 episodes now. Who would believe it? 50 episodes. And it's really just quite amazing. We've had a chance to talk about a lot of really fascinating topics, ranging from arts and music and culture. But most importantly, the central topic, which is the power and reach and voice that community radio gives us. Because as I was told the other day by a close friend of mine who also works in the business, that community radio really is one of the last free media spaces that's not being exerted control by a larger corporation or company. A lot of times, even a local paper will have opinions that are controlled by money. And in this case, our collective stations, we get a voice right into the community. So I think that's really great. And our community, in this case, is the world. Mm-hmm. So that's a really great thing. I really want to kind of get into, first of all, what you guys have, what your thoughts are, since you've been here now for a couple of days. What did you think the American election or the perceptions of the American elections were going to be like before you got on the plane? Anybody can take this one.
Okay. The elections, wow. I thought it was going to be quite interesting, crazy, because I've been seeing it on the news how everything has been going. So I was like, okay, I can't wait to actually see this myself, you know, the how everything goes down, what's happening, you know, being amongst the crowd. So it's I haven't been there, but hearing and leading up to it, it sounds interesting. And,
yeah. Anybody else have any thoughts about that?
So I was going to say, the same like with Lydia. Now, I haven't really fully experienced it yet. But so far, it seems like it's going to be very chaotic. There are a lot of people that has very strong opinions on what will happen, what the outcomes might be. But at the same time, people also still seem confused about what's happening around them.
Yeah, and I think Cody could probably speak to that a little bit. Cody is sort of our media master, especially when it comes to topics for folks that are in the Gen Z sphere. And I don't want to call you out like that, Cody, but you're definitely an expert when it comes to these things. You provide a lot of insight. Why is there so much information coming out from both sides right now? And how can you even fact check it?
The thing is, we're living in a time where we can actually send and receive information more rapidly. And as we've been able to increase the speed and flow of communication, we're also seeing a divergence to more partisan silos of media, which leads to less conversations across the aisle. On top of that, there's a privilege of time where many people are unable to dedicate time to research and fact-check information, let alone candidates and ballot measures in depth. That's where our role as journalists come into play, to summarize the information from our politicians accurately and succinctly. And so for me as a young person, where this is my first presidential election I'm eligible to vote in, which I was able to do for the first time.
All right.
I'm also in a battleground state where people on both sides of the aisle are deeply invested in their candidates and want to see their candidates succeed. Beyond the presidential election, though, I think it's equally important that we look to local elections. These are the people that are able to build rank and run for higher offices like senator, governor, president. So it's, for me, really important to look at your school board, your local judges, you know, city council members. Also, there's been many instances of people saying online that they thought they were registered to vote, but their record has been removed. A way to prevent that or ensuring that you're continually registered is to make a habit